facilitator. Jeffrey Morris is not able to be here today, so Lauren Bell, thank you, Lauren, will provide updates to the council and support the activities of today's meeting. Thank you to all the reentry council members and the interested public who are here today. So I would like to start by acknowledging my four co-chairs, Karen Fletcher, Chief Adult Probation Officer, Katie Miller, representing District Attorney George Gascon, Kathy Johnson, representing Sheriff Vicki Hennessy, Mauli Tugbenio, representing Mayor London Breed's office. So before we go around the table and have members introduce themselves, I'd like to formally welcome our newest mayoral appointee, Norma Ruiz. Welcome, Norma. We're excited to have you part of the council. And now I'd like to go around the table and ask the reentry council members to introduce themselves and Norma. When it's your turn, please feel free to share a little bit about yourself and your interest in serving on the reentry council. So let's get started. We'll start to our left here. Go ahead, Angelica. Oh, go ahead, sorry, yeah.
Angela Coleman, board appointed.
Juana Gray, OWC.
Jackie Marshall, Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing.
Jose Bernal, board appointed.
Good morning, Alan Nance, Chief of Juvenile Probation.
Norma Ruiz, Mayor appointed.
Oh, I'm happy to be here at the opportunity to offer my personal experience as a formerly incarcerated member and as a community member, and also serving the people of my community. I work in the mission as a case manager, and I work with girls ages 10 to 24 who are system impacted. So I'm here to offer that experience along with my experience as well. Thank you.
I'm Angelica Almeida with the Department of Public Health.
Mauli Tugbenio, Mayor's Office. I'm very excited for Norma to be here.
Karen Fletcher.
Sivan Shamji.
Kathy Johnson.
Katie Miller.
I'm Ian Fregosi with Supervisor Fuhrer's Office.
Christy Yarns, Senior Supervisor.
Hi, everybody. Susie Smith, Human Services Agency.
Laura Moyet, Department of Children, Youth, and Their Families.
Aspen Marshall, State Parole.
Frida Randolph-Lynn, on behalf of Karen Roy, the Department of Health Services.
Great, thank you very much.
Teddy Tolliver.
Oops, did I miss him?
Board, no, okay. Teddy Tolliver, board appointee. Hi, Norma.
Didn't mean to skip you there. Okay, thank you very much. We have a very interesting agenda. It's packed. So we welcome all feedback and comments from the members and the public. And if there's extended discussion on a particular item, the reentry division team will be keeping track of time and will let us know if we need to table an item for future follow-up. So at this time, let's move on to agenda item number 2. I'd like to give any member of the public who wishes to speak on any agenda item that's listed as discussion only the opportunity to do so. Okay, hearing none, then we will move on to agenda item number 3, the review and adoption of the meeting. So if you could look at agenda item number 3, and before we do that, I'd like to circle back to an outstanding question from the last meeting from the Reentry Council member Angela Coleman, who requested additional information on in-custody shelter and housing assessments. And so I would like Kathy Johnson of the Sheriff's Department to provide a brief update, please.
Sure. So this question came up at the last meeting. What we currently are doing is that Episcopal Community Services comes into the county jail system, and they go through the entire jail system, and they talk to the men and women who are incarcerated but are part of our programs. So currently we're targeting individuals in our programs and services, and they ask them a series of questions to determine homelessness and then to determine who would go back in and do a problem-solving task to get them connected with the reentry services in the community. So that's currently happening, has been happening for maybe 6 weeks concurrently, and it's today, and it coincides with the city's point-in-time census. Our staff and our contract service providers are also performing a survey to determine homelessness in the jail system. We anticipate that survey to take about 2 weeks. We target or we try to reach every individual that's incarcerated. That's going to be impossible. So if we can reach 1,000 individuals, that would be a very good survey. And then we'll present and produce a summary, an executive summary from that data to identify really the number of people that are homeless in the county jail system. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Assistant Sheriff Johnson. I like that. Okay, so let's take a few minutes and review the notes, and that's on page 3.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move that we adopt the minutes of the October 26th Unity Council meeting.
Second.
Okay, thank you, Chief Nance, for that motion, and a second from...
I just have one spelling correction.
Yes, absolutely.
On the CalFresh section on page 7 of the packet.
Okay.
I think it's all fine, but then the name, so it's Susie Smith, Olga Stavinskaya, -Velasquez. I can provide the spelling correction.
Okay.
And one other just factual correction on the second paragraph. It says there's been a decline in benefit enrollment among undocumented citizens. It's there's been a decline in benefit enrollment among households with undocumented citizens. So,
okay.
So did undocumented this... citizens are not necessarily eligible to be given.
Great. Thank you. And just to to be clear, the second was from Chief Fletcher, and then any discussions or comments. So thank you for those. Any other comments? Okay. Any public comment related to the minutes? Okay. Seeing none, I'd like to ask for a vote. All in favor of approving the minutes, say yes or aye. And all opposed? Okay. The motion passes. Before we move on to agenda item 4, we are hoping to make a little switcheroo. agenda item number 6, which is presentations on addiction treatment and treatment access points, we would like that to precede agenda item 4. So is there somebody who'd like to make a motion to do that?
So
thank you, Chief Fletcher. Is there a second?
I second.
Assistant Sheriff Johnson, I have to remember your long title. Any discussion? Any public comment? All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Motion passes. Okay. So we're moving right along to agenda item number 6. So agenda item number 6 is focused on a subject area that is the core of almost every criminal justice and public health conversation that we're having in San Francisco. And today we have several representatives across the public and private sectors who are here to make presentations and share viewpoints on the complicated realities of drug use, as well as city and community efforts to provide a support system and to provide treatment. So Commander Lazar of the San Francisco Police Department will start with a presentation on the Healthy Streets Operations Center, commonly known as HSOC, and Healthy Streets Intervention Program, HSIP. So thank you for being here, Commander Lazar.
Well, good morning, everyone, and thank you for the invitation, and thank you, Chief Fletcher and Lauren from Adult Probation for the invitation this morning. My comments will be brief. I was glad to hear you say that HSOC is commonly known, because a year ago it wasn't. On January 16th, 2018, we opened up our doors at the Department of Emergency Management, and the Healthy Streets Operations Center is a collaboration, really, between the Police Department, the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing, the Department of Public Health, the Public Works Department, the Controller's Office, 311. We've now added the Sheriff's Department, grateful for your partnership. We have added a variety of other agencies that are involved. Adult Probation has really taken a leadership role as of late, so we're excited about it. What Healthy Streets is about is, instead of working in silos to address homelessness and street behavior and really being separate in one city, it brings us all together, and for the lack of a better framework, it's like a command center. It's a command post that's set up. Something that we would do in emergencies. If we had an earthquake, or if we had a large fire or some disaster, we would all meet at the Department of Emergency Management and coordinate and collaborate together. Well, because of our homelessness issue and our drug addiction issues in our city, we're doing that on a daily basis. From 7 a.m. to 11 p.m., 7 days a week, we're in this room and we're collaborating and working together. And the police department has a role, because in terms of public safety, we work to make sure that our outreach workers are safe, that the public is safe. When it comes to some criminality issues, we're more geared towards getting individuals into treatment and services than we are jail. And so this collaboration has worked. One of the main focuses has been encampment resolution. As 2 years ago, we had around 1,200 tents in encampments all throughout our city. We're below 300 at this point. And really, at the end of the day, the main goal is to, number one, lead with services collaboratively. Number two is to make sure that people have a path to housing. And we all know what the situation is with housing, and you know the difference between shelter and navigation and permanent supportive housing. So that's our goal, and we're working towards that. And we're also trying to address the 22,000 or 25,000, depending on who you talk to, IV users in our city, and the poor situation that we have with that, and the fact that we need to help our folks here in our city. So the Healthy Streets Operations Center is up and running. The collaboration occurs every day. But the added element that I really want to talk about related to this topic is that what we call HSIP. We got a lot of acronyms, but HSIP is the Healthy Streets Intervention Program. And that's really a partnership between all of us at HSOC, Adult Probation taking the lead with the CASC on 6th Street, and the Department of Public Health. And what we're doing that is exciting, what the police department is doing that is exciting, I can speak on behalf of the department, is that our mindset is changing, in that we are doing our very best to recruit individuals who are addicted to drugs and get them to voluntarily come with us to go to the CASC, led by Adult Probation, Community Assessment Service Center on 6th Street, and to get people connected. And we go right from the street, right to 6th Street, to get them plugged in. And every day, our officers are out from about 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. working to get individuals into the CASC. And now, on a weekly basis, we include either Tenderloin Station on 1 week and Southern Station on the next week, where we get more officers, plus Adult Probation, plus all of our partners working on this, to get as many individuals as possible connected. And I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I know that we have been successful. It's not easy. People are not service ready, but we continue to chip away at this so that we can get people the help they need. To the point where, kind of after, similar to the LEAD model, where we may even place somebody under arrest if we have probable cause to believe that they've committed a crime, that being possession of narcotics, And if they're cooperative, we take them down to CASC and release them at CASC and connect them, warm handoff directly to an outreach worker that can help them. And so that really has been our strategy. And we will continue to do that work. And we see a lot of success in having those resources. So I want to thank Adult Probation for that partnership. I know we've worked to expand the hours. And I think one of the things we're doing in the police department is not only is it the officers assigned to the Healthy Streets Operations Center, which, by the way, tomorrow makes about 36 officers just dedicated to encampment resolution and HSIP, but to really get the mindset of our officers to think if you're walking a beat or you're on a bicycle or you're in a patrol car, to think about CASC as an option to get people down there voluntarily or otherwise. So that's my overview of HSOC and HSIP, and I know you have a big, large agenda, a lot of speakers, but I'm more than happy to answer any questions about what we're doing. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, thank you.
I have a question.
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
So when you talked about you're now at the CAD building, DM, Department of Emergency Management, right?
Yes.
And you have adult probation, you have a police department there. What community-based organizations are there?
So there's no community-based organizations that are with us in the actual command center. This is all city government that we're partnered with. 311 is the other partner I forgot to mention, as we work on 240 calls a day coming through 311. But we, through our representative of the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing, who actually works for Khaki Marshall, and I wanted to shout out for Khaki, who's here today, is my counterpart over at HSH. Yeah. HSH is connected to all the nonprofit providers. And I think today some of the HSOC officers are going to be live. So we have that partnership, but we have a representative in the command post that's connected to all the nonprofit providers. And when we need their assistance, that's who we go to.
Okay, thank you, Commander Lazar.
Thank you for the invitation.
Sure. Okay, Angelica Almeida with the Department of Public Health is going to do a presentation next. DPH Services.
In your packet as well as on the screen. But just to give you some background, so the Department of Public Health has an array of services through population health, behavioral health services, our medical team. Within behavioral health services, which works with individuals who have substance use disorder and mental health treatment needs, over a number of years we've developed many programs that work with individuals who have contact with the criminal justice system. And what we found is that it was challenging to have all those programs well coordinated. So our director of behavioral health, about a year ago, decided to create a system of care for individuals who contacted the criminal justice system to ensure that those services were well coordinated. So I became the director of forensic and justice-involved behavioral health. Currently, those programs include law enforcement-assisted diversion, drug court treatment center, community justice center, our coordination around mental health diversion, the violence intervention program, promoting recovering services for the prevention of recidivism, as well as some of our civil processes through assisted outpatient treatment and our coordination with the conservator's office. So I'm just going to give a brief overview of behavioral health services and then focus more specifically on two of our programs, which we've talked about here before. So just to give you a brief overview of behavioral health services, our services are focused on principles of recovery and wellness, trauma-informed care, and client-centered. And we really strive to have this a warm community where any door is the right door. And as much as possible to have low threshold services. What we have found is that increasingly we are adding staff that do outreach into the community, including peer-based services to do that. But of course, we always want to support individuals to thrive in their natural environments in a least restrictive setting. So this just gives you a very broad overview of our services. We provide services to individuals throughout the course of their lifespan. And our most intensive services are, and the most restricted, you'll see, are at the bottom of our pyramid. The least amount of individuals are in that part of our system. We try to, as much as possible, have early intervention programs and voluntary-based services, which account for most of our services in behavioral health services. So the voluntary services, which we'll talk about today, might include residential treatment, case management services, and peer-based services. Last year, we served 21,884 unduplicated individuals in our mental health services, and 6,611 individuals, unduplicated individuals in our substance use disorder services. That is likely an underestimate. There's been some changes in our tracking, and so our numbers for mental health services are much more comprehensive. But we do know there are individuals that bridge in both parts of our services. So in terms of access points, again, trying to make it so that there's no wrong door into treatment, we have a number of different access points into care. One of the points that I want to talk about today include our treatment access program and behavioral health access center. The goal behind this was to have a one-stop shop that's centrally located at 1380 Howard, where individuals can come in and have an assessment for substance use disorder treatment, as well as mental health services. And that's available in a variety of languages. There are some groups there for people who are waiting to enter residential treatment, and so to have a supportive environment to do that. And this just gives a little bit more detail about our different levels of care within behavioral health services. But I wanted to spend some time to talk about law enforcement assisted diversion, which the commander mentioned, as well as our role within the HSIC program. So law enforcement assisted diversion is a grant that we received through the Board of State and Community Corrections. And this was a recommendation of the Jail Replacement Project Work Group. We started the program in October of 2017. The grant is set to expire in June of this year. However, we do have a no-cost grant extension until December of 2019 to spend any remaining dollars that we have. As part of this grant, we are focused on the Tenderloin Admission Districts. And our goal is to serve a minimum of 250 individuals, but we will far exceed that, which I'll talk about momentarily. But this is a partnership between multiple city departments and community-based organizations, including the District Attorney's Office, the Public Defender's Office, Probation Department, Police Department, Sheriff's Department, BART Police, and community-based organizations, including Light and Felton, who are our case management agents. The goal of this grant was really to reduce recidivism, strengthen collaboration between partners, and improve health and housing status of participants. Part of that, I just got a little mixed up. I'm going to move to here and then I'll go back, so apologize for that. So part of that is that we wanted to make sure that individuals were able to be connected to services at the earliest point of contact with law enforcement. And this is based on a program in Seattle. And so there's two different types of referrals that they have in Seattle. The first is pre-booking referrals, which is where there's probable cause for arrest, but instead the individual is offered voluntary services as an alternative to arrest. Up until this point, we've had 70% of our pre-booking referrals have been for felony cases, which is great and something that we were really striving for throughout the program. The other thing that we have is called social contact referrals. And this came from, again, in Seattle, their program was initially all pre-booking referrals, but community members found out about the program, wanted to be connected to services, and because they were doing a research study to look at the efficacy of the program, they had what were called red light and green light days. Green light days being where people would be referred to the program, red light days where people were not referred so that they could have a comparison group. So individuals would actually walk up to officers and go, is it a red light or green light day? And if an officer said it was a green light day, they'd go buy drugs, come back, show it to the officer, and go, can I do the program now? And so Seattle really, of course, wanted to make sure that an individual didn't need to engage in what would be considered criminal behavior to participate in services, so created this idea of a social contact referral for individuals who are considered at high risk for arrest, or there's a history of involvement in the criminal justice system, and the individual wants to voluntarily participate. That has been most of what we've seen in terms of referrals that we've gotten from law enforcement, and it's been a really important part of the program. So looking at eligible charges, we were really limited initially by the grant. Under Senate Bill 843, there were specific charges that could be considered up for diversion into the program, which largely included possession or sales of a controlled substance and prostitution. We worked with the Board of State and Community Corrections on this throughout the course of the grant to expand the eligible charges for the program, because what we found is often individuals weren't being arrested for these charges, and we didn't want to support increasing contact with law enforcement. So the policy committee agreed to increase these charges to theft-related charges, vandalism charges, and auto burglaries. And I think that's been really helpful for us moving forward with our goals of the grant. So in terms of the services that we provide, how we've set this up, and you'll have a flowchart on, I believe, the next slide, but how we've set this up is that law enforcement would transport an individual or connect an individual to a Department of Public Health clinician. Again, what Seattle had is that if individuals had significant medical or psychiatric needs, they weren't able to be referred to the program and were instead transported to psychiatric emergency services. We wanted to make sure that we weren't creating any barriers to people accessing this program or services, so we made sure that we had a DPH clinician who could help triage needs immediately, do crisis assessments, go out into the community or hospital if that was indicated to assess individuals for the program so that that didn't exclude anyone. So we assess individuals on a number of different domains, and as I mentioned, we work with Glide and Felton to provide the case management services. Glide Foundation primarily works with individuals who are referred from the Tenderloin District, and Felton for individuals who are primarily referred from the Mission District. Felton, given their work in terms of offering intensive case management for individuals who have significant mental health needs, also has a clinician who can provide immediate clinical case management to an individual. Part of this was also that decided to work with two treatment programs is that in Seattle, if an individual had a stay-away order from another participant, they weren't able to participate in the program. And so by having two different agencies, that gives us the flexibility to move individuals around and connect them to care. So again, we're not excluding anyone. So the case managers not only work with individuals, provide harm reduction-based services and low-threshold case management services, they also do a lot of outreach into the community. And work to develop with the individual an individualized care plan. One of the primary benefits of participating in LEAD beyond getting connected to care is that if an individual completes their initial assessment within 30 days, that LEAD eligible charge is not filed. For other charges that we've decided to add to the program, there may be other requirements that an individual has, but certainly there's a legal benefit to participating. So this is just, again, a flowchart of how the program works. I want to take a little bit of time to give you the most up-to-date numbers that we have for the program. So thus far, we've had 273 referrals to the program, most of which have come from the police department. And I mentioned most have been social contact referrals. 62% of the referrals have been from the Tenderloin District. Again, I mentioned 70% of those pre-booking referrals have been for felony charges. Currently, we have 134 active participants, which I think is really impressive because, again, these are individuals who there were barriers to accessing care previously or they were not otherwise engaged in care for the most part and are now working with an ongoing provider who's able to support them. Currently, of our participants, 63% of those individuals are male and are white and African American. So 45% being white, 29% being African American. I think I'll pause there because I'm going to talk about a couple other different programs. I wanted to see if anyone has any questions about LEAD before I transition to the Healthy Streets Intervention Program.
Go ahead.
Do you have any data on the age of the active participants? I'm just curious if you keep track of the percent under age 25.
I appreciate that question. We do have that information. Unfortunately, I don't have it with me today. But I can tell you most of our referrals have not been that transitional age youth population. That's a smaller proportion of individuals that we work with.
Go ahead.
Yeah, Are there any situations or any reasons why a person wouldn't be able to receive a services? I work in the human services field, and I see time after time where people aren't able to receive the services because they're not from San Francisco or they don't have drug medicals. So is there any reason that a person wouldn't be able to receive the services?
So, again, because this is grant funded, we don't have limitations around funding. So we're able, there aren't any limitations for that.
Are you going to be able to sustain the program and the grant?
Yeah, that's something that, you know, we're very fortunate that we do have some cost savings. So we're crunching the numbers now to see how much further into this calendar year we're able to go. Our hope is that we'll be able to go through December of this year on the grant. And then we're having ongoing services about being able to continue the case, for the Department of Public Health's perspective, the case management that's offered. What we've seen is that it's been really important to have low threat case management for this population. And because individuals who primarily have substance use disorder treatment needs, there's not really case management services. We have a lot of those for individuals who have primarily mental health needs. We don't have a similar kind of program for individuals on the SUD side, so it's a really important part of our system addition. So we're talking about how to best continue to fund that.
Great, you want to continue with that?
So, building on the LEAD model, as the panel mentioned, is the Healthy Streets Intervention Program. I will also note that at HSOC we have a DPH representative who consults on cases. Part of what we have through HSOC is we've also hired an engagement team through Felton Institute to, again, offer low threshold engagement. And there's a lot that we've learned through the LEAD model that we're expanding to other parts of our system of care. So this allows for us to have a coordinated effort to offer services to individuals in the community, some who may be connected to LEAD, and some who are connected to other services. So just to give you some information from that, so looking at the week of December 24th to current, we've had 9 referrals that have been brought to the CAPS that we've been able to connect to services or talk to them about services and offer them resources. 8 of those individuals stayed to talk to a DPH staff member and either get connected to care or receive information about resources that they can access in the community. So also want to take a moment to talk about the Promoting Recovery and Services for the Prevention of Recidivism, which is another grant that we have through COP 47. This is also a grant that we have through the University of Community Corrections, but this grant goes through August of 2020. And what this was designed to do is to work with individuals who have substance use disorder treatment needs, who also have a history of contact with the criminal justice system. The Board of State and Community Corrections left this to be a very open statement of what that means. So it's any individual who's been arrested for, charged with, or convicted of an offense. This has been really helpful because it's allowed us to expand our capacity in terms of residential treatment services. One of the things related to the transitional age youth question from earlier, one of the things that we've heard is that often our substance use disorder services are not developmentally appropriate for transitional age youth. And so as part of this grant, we wanted to build in developing capacity for TAE youth and a specific curriculum to work with that population so that we can better meet those needs. Our goals for this grant are to engage adults with substance use and co-occurring disorders in treatment, develop a community plan of care, and also to reduce recidivism. So we accept referrals through this program through a number of different locations, including the treatment access program that I previously mentioned, the collaborative courts, offender treatment program, jail behavioral health services, and law enforcement assisted diversion. And it's funding 5 social detox beds at Salvation Army, as well as 32 substance use disorder residential treatment beds, also through Salvation Army Harbor Lights, where individuals can be for 3 to 6 months. We also wanted to include peer-based services, and so individuals who are completing the program have access to 60 days of peer-based services to transition back into the community. And I previously mentioned the TAE-specific work that we're doing, and that is a clinician through Felton Institute who not only works with Salvation Army and individuals who are in the program, but also partners with DPH staff to go into the community to engage TAE youth and services who have substance use disorder treatment needs. So going back, so currently we have 34 participants at the program, 5 in the social detox program, and 29 at the Harbor Lights program. Most of our referrals for this program have come through our treatment access program. For this population, current participants, most are male, and most are similarly to our LEAD program, Caucasian or African American. 22 of the 34 participants are between the ages of 26 and 43, and 2 are between the ages of 18 and 25, related to the TAKE question previously. So in terms of successes and challenge for both the LEAD and the PROSPER program, so I think one of our biggest challenges for LEAD is having housing opportunities, as was previously mentioned. We've been able to work closely with HSH to get people into coordinated entry and have them assessed. Some individuals have been successfully housed in permanent housing, but a lot of individuals aren't amenable to go into shelter or navigation centers, and so we continue to work with them in the community, but I think that continues to be one of our greatest challenges. But I think what's been really successful is being able to, again, engage with a population that we may not otherwise have had contact with, but certainly have service needs, to build those collaborations, not only with participants, but also the partners at the table. Part of the LEAD process is that we have a bi-weekly operational work group, so participants sign an authorization so that we can communicate with all of the partners at the table, and I think it's really helped to build those relationships, again, and support individuals to be in the community. I think related to the PROSPER grant, we had a slow startup because of some contractual challenges and just getting that rolling, but since we've done that, we've been really successful in getting people into treatment. One of the things that we are currently focusing on is making sure that we are getting referrals for individuals who are exiting custody, and there isn't a gap between when they're released from custody and when they can go into residential treatment. So that's one of the things we've been working with Salvation Army to focus on. Can I answer any questions about the PROSPER grant or anything else that I discuss?
Okay, seeing none, thank you very much, Angelica, for that presentation. Next, I'd like to ask Steve Adami to come up to the podium.
Hi, I'm Steve Adami, and I work for the San Francisco Adult Probation Department in the Reentry Division, and I'm here to talk about a recovery summit we hosted last May with the Senior Ex Offender Program. I think it was sometime in January of 2018 that Lauren, Jeffrey, and myself were walking to a coffee shop and came back, and we were just discussing the state of addiction in San Francisco. And I myself am in recovery, getting claimed by the greatest gift I've ever got. And Jeffrey said, you know, we should do a recovery summit, man, really talk about the success of people in treatment and celebrate recovery. You know, Lauren and Jeffrey were on board, so we got with the Senior Ex Offender Program, and we planned out this event, and it was really to kind of discuss different treatment options, talk about what's working, what's not. It's always a really difficult conversation because people are very passionate about their thoughts on addiction and recovery, and to really honor people and award people that have been in recovery for some time. Teddy received an award, Victoria, who's not here today, who did, and so did Alan. And several other people. And our biggest takeaway was we wanted to convene a working group of people in recovery that could kind of further the work of the summit. So there's like 4 salient points arose from the summit. The first one was that everyone thought San Francisco needed to offer longer treatment stays, that 30, 60, and 90 days was not going to do it. The second one was is that we thought the city should expand treatment options, that everything from safe injection sites to harm reduction programs to abstinence-based programs, the spectrum of programs that would help people get better because people recover in different ways. Third is that we thought the city should create a professional peer mentoring program into San Francisco's recovery efforts. And last is that the city should offer specific treatment services for transitional age youth. So we've been meeting regularly, we have subgroups, there's some people from the work group here today, and also Javier is going to come up after some of our members come up and talk about what the parallels are that we're working with on him. And as a next step, we're launching this survey, and it's in your packets, page 44. One of the critiques that's come up recently is that we rarely ask people in recovery for their opinion on anything. And so, you know, we all got clean, and, you know, we're very passionate about getting clean, and they have some good input. And so the survey not only asked people who are in recovery, but also people who have been impacted by recovery. Family members, loved ones, and other people. I'm sure my mom, she answered these questions, it would be shocking to most of us. So we're going to try to launch this through SurveyMonkey, and we'll have hard copies available. Our goal is to collect 500 to 600 surveys, and then we're going to share the information directly with, like, public safety and public health partners, and then figure out some next steps. We just think San Francisco could be better. As the commander said, there's 22,000 IV drug users. I learned yesterday there's 438. I might be wrong by a few treatment beds in San Francisco. So there's kind of an imbalance of stuff for people that want to get well. And if people want to get well, then we should be able to help them get there. So I'm going to ask some people from our group to come up, from the working group. They're just going to talk about their own personal experience in recovery and what part of this group has done for them. We are working on our next summit, which will be in, hopefully, May of this year. And we will get information out to you guys, so hopefully you can join in. We can just collectively kind of have more energy around recovery. So, Richard and Rachel, if you want to come up, you just give us a talk now.
Yes, I'll start. My name is Richard Beal. I'm the director of transitional housing for Kinemon Housing Center. It's good to see the chief and everyone and Teddy, and I want to thank Lauren and Steve for asking me to come. And Steve invited me to be on the working group. You know, it's been a really good experience. You know, I grew up in Richmond. No, I'm in recovery. I grew up in Richmond. When I was coming up, you know, I was going to school, and I got kicked out of pretty much every school I went to. I went to Harriers, got kicked out of there for game banging and fighting. I went to Kennedy, got kicked out of there for game banging and fighting. I went to Richmond High, got kicked out of there for game banging and fighting. I graduated from Richmond High Adult School at night because they said, if we see you in the daytime, we're calling the police. You know, when I was coming up in Richmond, I didn't know anything about no AA, no CA. Only A I knew about was the DA. That's it. Only when you got clean was you went to jail or you went to church. That was it. There wasn't no treatment and all that, none of that going on. And so what happened for me was I was continuing to start using drugs. My brothers was using drugs and everything, was selling drugs. 9 years old, I was selling 50 cent joints, $5 match boxes, and 3 minutes at 9 years old. You know, so I came up in a family that's all we did, that's all we knew. You know, so I truly understand that people can only give you what they got. My father gave me what he knew. He knew how to hustle, that's what he passed down to his kids. And so that's what I know, that, you know, people can only do what they know. In 1986, I had a stroke from using drugs. I had a plentiful, my family did it and all that. And that's what led me to come into the, I made a decision to join the Army. Salvation Army. I was 2 weeks out of the hospital, I had a stroke. I was in the hospital. I couldn't see, I couldn't talk. My father came in, and he was crying and everything, and I made a decision to go into the Salvation Army and everything in San Francisco. So I went to the San Francisco ALC, and that's how I came out of here. You know, that was in 1986. In 86, I went into my first program in 86, and I didn't get clean to stay clean. I didn't stay clean. That was my first program. That was a beginning of many. You know, I went through 8 different treatment centers and 53 detox episodes. And the reason I know, because I ended up working 5 years at that detox. You know, my recovery really started in July 4th, 1995. I went on my last run for like 2 weeks. You know, I went over my father's house. He did what he always did. He never told me the door on me. I walked into the basement. They was getting high. They were drinking. They were smoking all that type of stuff. I went on 2 week run. And then, you know, I came back out to San Francisco on the 18th of July in 1995, and I went to Ozanam Detox. And I said, that's it, I'm done. You know, San Francisco exceeded any other place when it came to substance abuse treatment. It didn't have any services that I knew about any, you know, in a lot of other places, you know, where you can get in easily. You know, because you knock on the door at the Ozanam, they just open the door and lay you on the mat. That was it. They didn't turn away, away nobody. I ended up working at that detox for 5 years. And so I went into the detox on July 18th, and I went into St. Anthony's. A guy came from St. Anthony's came and did a presentation. did a presentation that I see saying, hey, if you want to come, just come to 50 Jones Street and sign up. We take everybody. We're not funded by the city. And then he said, no background check. I said, no background check. You know what I'm saying? I said, no background check because I have full felony warrants, you know. I ain't got them now.
You look at
me. I have four felony warrants, you know. You know, so I went in July 20th, 1995. I went to St. Anthony's. I went work therapy program. I went through that program and I graduated the primary program at Seton Hall, you know, after 6 months. And then I went to court. I told them that I had some legal stuff I needed to take care of. I went to court and they set up and they busted all those felonies down for misdemeanors. I went to the secondary at Covenant House at 818 Steiner Street. I completed that program, you know, the secondary program, and they dismissed all the cases. You know, and that was a result of just showing up. You know, when I got clean, I started a group when I was going to the treatment and everything. I was told to you know, get with, you know, men get clean with men and all of these things, and get you a support group and go to meetings and get involved with service. And I did everything they told me to do. I did when they told me to go to meetings. I went to meetings every day for the first 5 years. You know, they told me to get involved with a service with a support group. I got involved with Men in Motion, and that support group was just celebrated 28 years. You know, and so I just got involved and did what they told me to do. People that was here before me, my predecessors. And so I did what they told me to do, got a sponsor, did everything, still got a sponsor, still doing service, still secretary of meetings today. You know, and so I continued to do what I did. And then after I completed the secondary program, I didn't have no place to go. I didn't want to go back to Richmond. You know, I said, I'm going to stay out here in San Francisco. And so what I did was I signed up with the Salvation Army to get into Bridgeway. And Bridgeway at that time was is 242 Turk Street, now it's the Croc Center. And so Salvation Army Bridgeway, I went to the transitional housing. And I stayed there for 3.5 years. And it was a requirement while I was there. They didn't have no time, as long as you paid the rent, as long as you went to, you had to go to two meetings every week. It didn't matter whether it was AA or NA or whatever, you had to go to two meetings a week, and then you had to just pay like $350 a month, and you could stay there as long as you want. I stayed there 3.5 years. You know, and during that time, you know, after 6 months, I was going down to the house and I was doing meetings, secretary meetings, doing everything. They took me, Vicky took me upstairs and said, sign that paper right there. And that's how I got my job working at the house and I didn't apply, I didn't turn in no application, I didn't do none of that. She just took me upstairs after volunteering in the kitchen for 90 days, had Rosemary McLeod. At that time, she had 40 years almost, I think, at that time. You know, they signed me up and I started working at the house and I worked there for 5 years. And then I went from there to working at Head Ashbury Free Clinics. Started going to school, worked at Head Ashbury. I started off as a regular counselor, then went from a counselor to case manager, from case manager to intake coordinator, from intake coordinator to center manager to managing all their residential programs on Treasure Island. Center for Recovery, Western Addiction, all the programs that we started there on Treasure Island, I managed all of those programs. I left it, they merged with HealthRight 360, and then I went to CenterPoint, and then I started running the programs for Rose Recovery in San Bruno Jail. You know, so I got a long history here. It's been like, I've been out here like 33 years, been working in this field in San Francisco community for straight, ever since I've been here, 23 plus years, going on 24 years. You know, it's been an experience. You know, going through from being homeless, to going to treatment, to going to transitional housing, to working in the community, to just working with people coming out of incarceration. So I did in custody programs and I did out of custody programs. And so now today I am the director, the interim director of transitional housing, contracted with the probation department. We have the Drake, we have the Heart, we got clients at the Broadway. And I want to talk about a little about, you know, they talk about the supportive housing and everything and the supportive housing SROs. But what I tapped into was the private SROs. The ones that don't have all the support into them. The ones that don't, you know, I did some beat walking, you know, and some research and just reached out to some private SROs, and that's how I found the Roy Lee, and that's how I found some other opportunities for people to get some permanent stable housing. And so it's really grateful, I'm really grateful for that. Yeah, I'm getting ready. You know I know. All right. It just ran on my breath. But anyway, it's been a wonderful experience. You know, like I said, I want to thank the Chief of Operating on Housing Clinic. You know, the opportunity. What I want to really just mention before I sit down is that the bridge, you know, between residential service, transitional housing, and into stable and permanent housing is not there. You know, it's difficult to tell a client that you've been in housing free for 1 year, and the best way that you can get them to stay with permanent housing, go back to a shelter. Go back to a shelter because you don't make enough money to be eligible to apply for a lot of the housing opportunities. I mean, it's like 5%. Somebody on SSI and GA, 5%. You know, a lot of times I built up some relationships with some private landlords, and we have had the opportunity to get some shared housing opportunities at some of the SROs. And that's the best thing going right now, because their income is like $300, $199 if you're in transitional. And, you know, it's just very, very difficult. So I want to thank, you know, Chief Lesher, Lauren, Steve, for the opportunity and everything that he's given to me, Tenant Law Housing Clinic, and all the staff that I work with on a regular basis, and definitely the participants. I truly believe in the harm reduction principles, but it's difficult to practice harm reduction principles in an absence-based modality. But I truly believe that behavioral outbursts are clinical opportunities. I expect clients to act out. But it's our job to provide the best services possible. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Sabrina Reed. I currently work with the Sheriff's Department with Community Works West. I do the NOVA, I'm the NOVA case manager. That's my 9-to-5. And on top of that, I am going to be presenting. I'm one of the founding members of the ARC Bay Area chapter. And also, I'm a DA's board of formerly incarcerated individuals. There's not really too many places I'm not in on my own time. And that is all because I went to Atlanta Street in 2010 for 5 years and changed my life. I was in and out of, I've been in everything. Juvenile hall, 4 years. State prison, federal prison. I was a heroin addict for 25 years. And I would have never been where I'm at right now if I hadn't had an abstinence-based program. I understand there's lots of different ways of doing things. What's frustrating is to kind of watch not much working. You know, at some point we have to kind of reevaluate what's going on from a humanistic standpoint. I don't like watching people be the worst of themselves. And I feel like what a lot of me, in the big picture, my personal opinion, and which is not very popular. but I'm saying it anyway. I've been a junkie. I have been arrested and in front of the DA's office, you know, 27 times. You know, I understand like what being a criminal and a junkie is, and the things that happen now, it would have never happened back then. So I don't know what the solution is, which is, you know, kind of crazy, but allowing somebody to be on the street and shooting up in the daylight in public with a phone and a mirror and in their neck while 3-year-olds are walking by. Like, what is that? And what are we doing? I'm not saying either one of these are a solution. I've had to, with the Sheriff's Department, adopt some of the harm reduction policy, and I get it. I get harm reduction from the 70s in New York with junkies and needles in the AIDS epidemic. That is harm reduction to me. And so adapting that to here has to be more than just, okay, we'll work with that. You know, oh, it happened again. Let's work with that. That person doesn't have a bottom. And without a bottom, you're not going to change your life. Period. What that bottom looks like, I don't know. I know what it looks like for me, and that was, you know, getting in trouble and having to either make a choice in my life, do I want to do 15 more years in prison, or do I want to change something? It took a long time. I'm 15. This happened when I was 40. But, you know, I'm grateful for my own personal recovery, and I'm grateful that I get to, because I don't work for the city of any kind, I get to go to the home office. I get to go everywhere and kind of do things under the table. There's a group of us that meet. Oh, I won't front you off. In the dark, under the table, and try to make things happen. There's a few of you here. And then also, you know, things are, you know, what happens in some of your projects? What happens in the places that don't get to come here? What happens in the places that where people don't have choices? They don't have transportation or can't get here because they can't go through a neighborhood. You know, so many things don't happen for people in these areas. And I'm a white girl from Menlo Park, and I know this. You know, see, to me, my personal opinion is there's a lot of stuff going on, and nothing's really happening. And that's just my, like I said, my own opinion. But I'm still trying, and I will definitely offer my support. Well, when we do our presentation, we'll kind of go over what we're doing, and that's it.
Hi, my name is Alexandra. I'm from San Mateo. I graduated from USF last month. I'm in Narcotics Anonymous. I volunteer in Redwood City in the jail in the Choices program. They let me come in and do Narcotics Anonymous programs at meetings, and I also get to facilitate my own workshops where I get to design curriculum for them. And right now I'm doing a 7-week growth mindset curriculum for them. So, yeah, growth mindset for them. Yeah. I'm on this reentry committee where we try to advocate for better treatment options for addicts. But, you know, I used to be a homeless drug addict, and it wasn't until I was like 100 pounds and I had about 6 teeth left and I thought I was going crazy and I found out that I was pregnant that I decided to enter treatment. Typically don't share that with strangers, so excuse me, I feel more comfortable. I was able to live in a program in San Mateo County that allowed me to stay there for six months to a year, which I really needed. It was an abstinence-based program. I ended up staying there for 7 months, and you know, I've been clean and sober ever since, and that was back in 2011. Thank you. I should have been, you know, getting high anyways. But what I want to tell you is that 3 months into the program, like right at the 90-day point of my longer-term program, I had a conversation with my counselor, and I told her that I was going to leave to go get high with the baby in my stomach. I would like to stand up here and tell you that I'm not that kind of person, because today I'm a really good mom. You know, my son's dad died because he was a drug addict, and we go to therapy, and we're really good. He does sports. He's a happy kid. He's a great belt in jiu-jitsu. He's 6, and he's stronger than me. I'm a really good mom, but there was a point when he was in my stomach, and I told my counselor I was going to leave to go get high, and then I told her, you know, between you and me, I know that you typically kick people out for this. It's a very strict program, but you know, I'm pregnant. I know they're going to do that to me. I know you'll just start me over from day one. So bye, and I'll be back tomorrow or 3 days, you know, whatever. And I don't know. She said something that got me to stay there. I wish I could remember what it was, but I don't remember. It was probably something super rational. but I stayed. And if you hear nothing else from us on this committee today, I want you to hear this. Abstinence-based programs are extremely important, and longer episodes are extremely important. At 90 days, I wanted to go get high, and I didn't care that my son was in my stomach. And that's just what my addiction was. That's how strong it was. So that's what I'd like you to hear today, and it's really important for me, and that's why I advocate for this cause. Thank you.
Keep this kind of short. I went in and out the system after she passed. And I found her dead
overdosed out here in the house. I didn't cry for over 16 years about it. I was good at it. And I cried at the older brother. I cried really about it 16 years later, about it in the yoga class at RGP of the San Bruno. Yeah, like 2 years later, they asked some questions I was trying to find about it. But as time went on, I still was in and out the system. I went to foster home, group homes, in the jailhouse. I think I beat the record going in out of 855. It was like I was a good worker there. It was a change throughout the process to go to the work spot. And you let me detox, crack. I've had it all. I know what it is to feel like doing concrete. I know about the tunnel system. 3 years ago, I've been in and out of all the hospitals before, so I turned this up by 360. This and that. But my last round here 3 years ago, I just couldn't do it no more. I couldn't do it for the courts. I couldn't do it for my family, my kids, none that had to really do this for me. I had people that were supporting me, that really believed in me. I had a few deputies in there that supported me. Brian was one of them, who worked on the entry pod. Never gave up on me. George Durando, Dr. Jones, positive direction. You know, with the probation department, that would be the king. She's one of my probation officers that was looking through the journey. So for me to be here to talk about it. But what I really learned, okay, let me go back. What I really learned when I was going out these programs and I went over to sober living, they ended up the system so much, So I came to find that I was codependent and I didn't have life skills outside of being in jail or the penitentiary. I mean, I do every penitentiary can be, and like I say, in and out the county jail. So they know my name firsthand basis, and they call me Pup. My mother gave me that name when I was a baby because I was really fat. Cartoon Puff, not Dragon, my favorite cartoon. So that's how I got the name Puff. But when I came to find out that I didn't know how to cook on the stove, I didn't know how to go clothes shopping, I didn't know how to, just being out here in society. So I did a whole lot to always go back in and be, taken care of. So 3 years ago, I had to find out that I need life skills. I need to learn how to function out here in society. And that's what a lot of us that's going through out here with this homeless population and the drug population. I've been ran all through this TL, this street, under the freeways, under the bridges. I didn't been a part of all of this. So I know what a lot of us is going through. And we can start doing more programs about getting these workshops going, about helping people learn how to do life skills, learn how to live out here, learn how to function. A lot of us don't know how to do it, even though we got these, navigation center and all these programs. People going up in there because it's cold, it's hot, or whatever the situation is. Are we making a treatment plan? Sometimes we got to hear them. We got to really like listen to them, what they really need and what they want. Really be open minded to it. And that's what been helping me with my support system, probation with Steve and them. They really like sit down and just like really want to know what was going on. And that's what I do. I know you talk about recovery, but like I tell people, I'm absent from drugs and alcohol, and that's been 3 years, and I'm still learning recovery. I'm still learning how to recover. I'm recovering from a whole bunch of life inside of me. I tell my folks, I tell people, I'm in process. I'm processing everything on how to function out here and how to do this work. How to be a light to the darkness that's up in there. So thank y'all very much for having me.
Good morning, Bill. Thank you for allowing us to speak today. I'm in recovery as well. In 1991, due to my addiction, I found myself facing homicide charges. In 1992, subsequently convicted of murdering Matthew Aguilera. In high school, I was known as the guy that had the best parties. And even a year after high school, I was still living up to that reputation. I entered prison angry, confused, sad, and lost. I maintained my addiction for years, moving from alcohol to heroin. It wasn't until years and years later, my peers within the system, peers from outside fired, and they were my helping hand. So with them, I learned how to be so. I learned coping skills. I learned strategies to maintain support. After 27 years in prison, I was released in May of 2013. After that, I met the wonderful people of the past. 3 weeks after that, I was working on Beth. I understand what addiction is. I've seen the state of addiction here in San Francisco. And I'm here to help. Not only do I want to maintain my sobriety, but I want to help others get sober. I'm currently working two jobs, full-time. One at a medical clinic, and one at a detox. Dual diagnosis for a mental facility. I see clients running gamut from the wealthy who helped us with cocaine and bottle rock to the homeless. Addiction knows no boundaries and affects everybody's opinion. Seen the news the other day about an individual who got stabbed with a needle on 8th Street in Market. Sad because I was thinking about my family. What if they're walking down the street? What was in that neighborhood? Was it contaminated? That's Joe Citizen. And that's that. It wasn't another addict. It wasn't a drug dealer. Not to say that those were less. But it's sad that that happens here. So I'm on this committee. Not only due to my addiction, but I want to make a change in the way the process is working. So I've seen it firsthand. I work with clients daily. I know what addiction is. Thank you, guys, for the question.
Thank you all for coming. Really appreciate it. You know, we realize that it's really an all hands on deck approach, and there's tons of different strategies, and they're all effective. People are at different stages of change, and people need different interventions during those stages. What works for one person might not work for the other. I think collectively our goal is to get everybody to the top of the mountain so they can all have a good shot at life like we got. How that happens and when it happens, people are on their own time frame, but I think the goals are all the same across the board. So, saying that, one of our partners at Lauren and I came to know Javier from Community Housing Partnership. He oversees a coalition called Treatment on Demand. And we went to a behavioral health services audit where he presented, and where I found out between October of 2014 and November of 2017, there was 49,000 bookings in the county jail, and 85.5% of the people were self-admitted substance users, which I thought was shocking. I mean, I've said my whole life that I really never did time with anybody, or if you dug deep enough, drugs and alcohol were part of this. Maybe they stole a pair of shoes, but if you got lower and lower through the story, you found drugs and alcohol somewhere. So I'm going to invite Javier to come up and talk about his work and kind of talk about how we're going to partner with you on the next step.
Hey everyone, excuse me, I'm a little stuffy nose. My name's Javier. I'm a community organizer with Community Housing Partnership, which is a supportive provided housing organization here in Tanglewood, based in Tanglewood. We started back in August on the Treatment on Demand campaign, and we brought together people from city departments, such as the Public Defender's Office, different community organizations, advocacy groups, people from the Department of Public Health, what was an important component of it too was to have members of the community who were having a seat at the table, talking about what were the issues and what our plan B is moving forward. This originated from was back in 2008. We were a part of a similar coalition that got Proposition T passed on the ballot, which was called Treatment on Demand, which said that the Department of Public Health would come up with a report talking about what was the need in San Francisco for substance use treatment, and then the city was, based off of that report, supposed to provide the funding and provide the access that people that would meet the need in San Francisco. Obviously, 10 years later, when we're 10 years later, we're not at that point. So what is different about this campaign is that what we want to encompass substance use disorders and mental health disorders, right? Because we know that those are mutually reinforcing issues that people face. And for Community Housing Partnership, all of our residents are formerly chronically homeless. And so if you can imagine, almost all of our residents are suffering from either substance use disorders or mental health disorders, or both. And that can also be a cause and a result of homelessness, substance use and mental health disorders. So like what's been said already, the goal of our campaign is to change San Francisco's approach to behavioral health and to substance use and mental health disorders, and to take what was recommended from that hearing in December, which was the performance audit. Because in the report, there were about 15 recommendations, and they were specific about supporting housing and specific about criminal justice reform related to behavioral health systems. But the only focus that we saw was about the bookkeeping with the Department of Public Health. And so from the people presenting at the time. So we saw that as like a gap in what the community needs and what it's asking for, and the effort that's being put forward about addressing the intersectionality of what should be our San Francisco's approach to addressing these issues. So we want to talk about, our campaign is going to push forward the idea that this is going to be a multi-pronged approach that we're going to need to use that includes increases in supportive housing, criminal justice reform, and increasing the budget for these, increasing the access and making treatment be something that if you ask for it that day, you don't have to wait for 4 to 6 weeks with a lot of hoops to jump through. So the biggest part about this campaign that I want to echo what's been said already is that the community and the members of the community and the people who are most affected by these issues need to be the ones who are a part of the decision making and the policy making and the planning that goes forward. Because it's not just about showing up to rallies and that the community can get involved in, it's about them having a seat at the table and being able to say, this issue affects me, this is what I think needs to happen going forward. And these are the solutions that I see that need to go into whatever plan that San Francisco is gonna have to retool and remake so that we can really face this crisis. So that's what I'm here to present, and I'm open for anyone in San Francisco to join the coalition because it's a big fight, and we're gonna need all hands on deck. So thank you very much.
Okay, so some next steps. We will get you information on the upcoming recovery summit, and we'll make sure to report back on the results of the survey. And if you have any questions, you guys can reach out to us.
Great, thank you.
Yes,
of course, absolutely.
First of all, I'd just like to acknowledge the presenters today. Oftentimes, I'll speak for myself, I find myself in meetings like this where we have a lot of policy discussions and a lot of great ideas are discussed, and we often launch down a path to implement these ideas, and it's often devoid of the lived experiences of the folks who are impacted by those decisions. And so hearing your presentations today really provided the realistic, on-the-ground, lived experience that should inform the policy decisions that we make. And so I just want to acknowledge how much I personally appreciated your stories that you had to tell, how heartfelt that they were, and how impactful that I believe they will be in helping us to make good decisions with respect to reentry for folks with chronic substance abuse challenges. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes, council member?
And I just have a microphone.
It was a city conversation. I'm so excited to be here. Hi, Laura.
Hello.
Excited
to have you here.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you guys so much for your stories. I know I popped out for a second. I was double booked on actually the first of several conference calls with the Women's Resource Center, which we're hoping to.
Not yet.
Anyway. I just wanted to say I went to Osmo, and we worked at CenterPoint at the same time.
Yes.
So it's amazing to be able to be here at this place and at this time and to be part of the council and to also see, my story reflected back to me by people who are showing up and holding folks accountable for the decisions that are being made and making sure that framing the issues includes the voice of people most impacted by them, as well as any of the interventions that we might be structuring to address the barriers that folks are facing and accessing opportunity structures and coming out of life and getting successful at avoiding recidivism. So, got clean in 1997, worked at CenterPoint, helped St. Anthony's start the California Addiction Recovery Resources curriculum when we first started having to have certification, and it's really great to just be in this room and be here, and thank you for showing up and doing all the work and having your heart. I know I owe you an email.
Great. Any other comments by the council members or any questions? I also want to thank each and every one of the speakers for your courage, for your inspiration, and for being leaders in San Francisco. And there are, we heard there's about 25,000 IV users. There are about 17,000 people who find themselves arrested and in jail throughout through the year. And they're going through things that you went through a long time ago. And to hear all of your voices now and for you to share that and to be part of that change is really inspirational, and so thank you for your time. So we're going to move back to agenda item 4, and I'm going to ask our wonderful Lauren Bell to come up here from the Adult Probation Department and give council members a staff update on the activities of the Reentry Council and its subcommittees. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Simon. And before I start, I do want to also just extend my appreciation. A lot of the speakers that came up I know pretty well, and I feel so emotional by the words that you shared, and it's hard and it's so important. So thank you very much for being here. Appreciate it. So the staff updates, they're all listed on your agenda. I'm going to just dive right in and start first with racial equity. The council made a commitment a while ago to maintain racial equity as a standing agenda item, obviously with the goal of having a collective impact along with other city departments on improving racial equity in San Francisco. So by now, most of you are aware of the city's partnership, the Government Alliance on Racial Equity, or CARE. But as I was thinking about this meeting, I know we've talked about it. I just don't know that we've ever actually kind of fully described it. So inside of your packet on page 10, there's a really good overview of HRC's CARE-led program. It includes a definition of racial equity, which I think is always an important anchor point for everybody, that we're talking somewhat about the same thing across every department. Thank you for coming, Mobley. We appreciate you. And the overview also provides insight into GARE activities and presents a snapshot of racial equity challenges in San Francisco. Obviously, there is a lot of work to be done. A new cohort led by HRC just started in January, and it's very exciting because many criminal justice partners are expanding their presence in GARE. So we also have Tawana Gray here from OED, who's been with GARE for a couple of years. And I don't know if you want to share a couple of thoughts just on your experience with it, just real quick.
Thank you, Lauren. It's been a great experience. I think, you know, just as a city, racial equity, when we're talking about work within the different departments, that ends up being the fundamental issue. And so, you know, for our department, realizing that that's an important part of our work and our accountability to the public, and also doing it in a way where recognizing, you know, that race is a sensitive topic, you know, for our nation and just the foundation and history of our nation from the beginning until now. So, like, and then with that, trying to figure out how to best collaborate with the departments to address it in a way where we can say, hey, we're giving money, we have these programs, are we really making the impact, you know, that we're saying, and are we really reaching the people that we're saying we want to reach through the through the different programs we serve. So it's been a lot of work. It's a process. I think it's necessary that this work happens, because if it doesn't, we'll end up talking about it in some other way. Because like I said, if you look at all the data, when you look foundationally, race ends up being at the crux of all the work we're doing. So, like I said, our department has made it a priority. Joaquin, who was our director, he actually participated in GARE too, so having his support is important. And currently, we're just continuing to expand. GARE has expanded its reach to different departments, so it's just a continuance of building from the ground, but also encouraging leadership to be open to it and really explore the different principles within it. So it's been a great experience, and I look forward to continuing to work with the different departments and also on this council to see how we can in some way impact this racial equity work and the work we do.
Thank you so much, Tawana, and we're so happy to have you here as a representative of OED too.
Happy to be here too.
And you made a good point. When it comes to achieving racial equity, it might not always feel like it's going to happen with this big loud bang from a conference, kind of one particular instance. It's going to happen from a day-to-day grind of how we're thinking about working with people of different races, how we're making sure that people of different races have access in new ways that they don't currently have to services, to educational opportunities, to employment. We also have to keep reminding ourselves of successes that happen along the way as well. So I just wanted to bring a couple up for you. As you guys know, Tara Anderson and Jafria Morris have really been moving the needle on criminal justice GARE work through the racial equity statement and also through the racial equity work group. A third meeting of that work group happened just yesterday, where everybody is continuing to drill down into the action plan and looking at what does this action plan really say? How can we actually make it something that works for the city? And also, how can we turn to our leaders and ask our leaders what budget items might be needed to really influence and move this work forward? Another great success of GARE is from the San Francisco Arts Commission. So inside your packets on page 12, there's an Examiner article. The SF Arts Commission is participating here, and their team, their department, has become the first department to adopt a racial equity plan. Some of their efforts will include applying racial equity as a lens when they're evaluating people who submit proposals to commission artwork, to get grants, or to exhibition opportunities. And they are also going to establish racial equity outcomes in their department. So that's a big deal. And to piggyback on something that Tawana said earlier with OED, Through their work on GARE, they've also incorporated racial equity, diversity, and inclusion plans in their RFP, making sure that anybody that's applying to city-funded grants put a plan in there. So if you aren't already in your departments, especially city departments, talking to your GARE representatives, just really encourage people to engage with them so that the criminal justice system can make a GARE impact as well. So moving on, I also wanted to talk to about the women's gender responsive work of the council. We also committed to maintaining that as a standing item. There's several departments. Obviously, the community does tremendous work with women's gender responsive. I'm going to highlight some of the work of our departments. Adult probation has 4 finalists for a women's gender responsive position, and we're working towards making an offer very soon. As a reminder, this person's role will help the our department strengthen our women's gender responsive approaches, and they will also be a bridge builder with other departments in the community. In late February, we're going to launch a womanhood curriculum. Several deputy probation officers stepped up. They wanted to be trained and to be able to deliver this curriculum to our clients. So they are going to start at the end of February, as I said, with a cohort of about 12 women. We also are rolling out gender identity, an initiative, and this initiative is going to help our DPOs be able to communicate better with our clients around cis and trans kind of communications, making sure that we're better capturing the needs of our trans clients. Over the last 3 months, APD also launched partnership with Sister Circle, which many of you know, which is a trauma-informed process group for women. There are regularly 8 to 10 women at these meetings. So in October, we, I think as many departments did, also hosted a domestic violence awareness event that brought many survivors and support systems to the table. I think the WRC was mentioned earlier, and really want to highlight some key successes there too. In addition to their day-to-day programming, in December, the WRC held a holiday event, including gospel music and community building for families. In November, there's a Thanksgiving meal. In October, there's also a DV awareness event. I did want to give a shout out. I did want to give a shout out to Angie Wilson in the department. She did an incredible job of organizing dozens of women to attend the Medea projects, When Did Your Hands Become a Weapon? And she was also in the performance. And I attended one of the opening nights, and it was just an extremely deep, difficult, but moving performance that just reminded us of the violence and trauma that women, but especially our justice and most women, have to carry every single day. So other updates, just really quickly from the DA's office. Obviously, been following a lot of stuff from the Victim Services Division. They held a gun violence restraining order presentation. In the same month, there was also a workshop on the signs and indicators of labor and human trafficking. In November, they launched a recruiting for a victims of crime advisory group, and they also held a DA-led Reclaiming the Power domestic violence event. And then you guys are also, Katie, you just put out an RFP for proposals to be submitted for victims of crime services grants, and the pre-proposal conference for that will be on February 1st at 10 a.m. So there are many, obviously, great efforts aimed at improving our collective work with women, but there's still a lot of work to be done. So I want to switch gears really quickly and turn your attention to page 15 of your packet. And Tawana, if you don't mind, once again, just giving the council a quick overview this time of the Prison to Employment Initiative that you guys are working on.
Hello, everyone. I'm actually just giving a brief update. My colleague, Jen Hand, who is with our strategic initiatives division. Next meeting, she'll come give a more thorough presentation. So in summary, this Prison to Employment Initiative is part of a large state grant to our regional workforce development planning unit. Again, we'll provide a full presentation next meeting. This planning effort is for the initiative, and it involved our required planning partners, which included the Sheriff's Department, Adult Probation, and the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. We have solicited input from community-based organizations and community members through a stakeholder engagement strategy for the past 6 months. Through this shareholder engagement strategy, we have developed a solid program design which incorporates four components that's laid out on this one pager, page 15. And I'll discuss the four components briefly. And this program design has informed the planning process and the program proposal for our entire regional planning unit. The grant is due February 15, and we are applying for $2 million as a unit. The grant lifetime is 2 years, and the award announcement will be made in April and July. So just to summarize the four components, the funding is available for direct services, for workforce development, supportive services, and implementation activities over a 2 year period. It will include comprehensive in-custody training for sector-based training in construction and hospitality, system referral and case management. So that encompasses the in-custody job center and a post-release work plan, which I didn't know about. I haven't been in those discussions, but I know we had talked about navigation centers through at the retreat. So as I'm thinking, that may be an opportunity for me to at least give feedback in that regard. And then also information and sharing. OEWD, the Sheriff's Office, and Adult Probation will develop a process to share data in order to avoid duplication of services. And then also the supportive services component. So like I said, Jim will be able to explain more and give you a more in-depth understanding of this initiative.
Thank you so much, Juana. It's exciting. Allie's at a lot of those meetings as well, and the whole thought about having the in-custody to the post-release employment workforce development connections with OED, obviously, as kind of the lead, is very exciting, right?
Yes.
We have so many people that are in custody that come out and start anew. The information hasn't been transferred, so this grant can be a really good streamlining process. So thank you, you guys. I know we're starting to run short on time, and obviously we want to make sure that the ARC has a chance. We just need to give some very quick updates on subcommittee work. So I'm going to briefly just direct your attention. Inside of the packet, there are notes from the December 3rd subcommittee retreat, which was very well attended. It was an amazing location, well facilitated. Jeff Rhea led all of us at that meeting. A lot of very interesting ideas have come up. They're listed in your packets. The next steps are going to be to take those ideas and for each subcommittee to turn it into a plan of action that will be brought to you guys at the next Reentry Council meeting. So before I go into the direct subcommittee's update, I did want to turn it over to the chair of the LPP subcommittee, Jose Bernal, to give a quick update.
Yeah, just a quick update on the policy subcommittee. We met yesterday, have scheduled another meeting for next month, and this meeting will be a strategy meeting to really narrow in, taking a lot of the suggestions that were brought to us on the retreat, to narrow in on 3 to 4 goals that we really want to focus on for this year. So that meeting is scheduled for February 13th. And if you're on that subcommittee, we will be reaching out to you because it's really important to have you there at the table for that meeting. Other thing that came up was we want to start bringing some state bills that we want to support. We want that conversation to start now. I don't anticipate that next meeting in February, that's what we're going to narrow in, but we do want to start getting some support and start putting some bills on the table that we can take a stand on. Another thing that I think is important is, and I'm later on in the agenda, actually, I'm going to have to leave shortly, but there is a current ordinance that is making its way. It's Hillary Roman's, Supervisor Roman's ordinance to change the administrative code that basically, so a little background, last year there was a state bill that basically changed the way that juveniles were interrogated by police. So it said that 15 and under, you know, you essentially had to get, you had the right to an attorney, you had the right to have your parents there. San Francisco, being the leader that it's always been, wants to make it 17. Well, Hillary Rodin, Supervisor Rodin's office, is putting forward something that it would basically make it 17 and under. So the subcommittee was really interested in that. I think that, you know, as an advisory council, you know, to the Board of Supervisors, I think that's something that we could, you know, hopefully have a discussion around and potentially an action. The next time that this council meets, it is plausible that it would have already been voted on by the Board of Supervisors, but I do think it's important for us to, you know, have a discussion around that. So that's an update, I think, unless I missed something. Yeah, okay.
No, sorry, I was just signaling to Sabrina
that
she's done.
Yeah, I don't think I think that's it in terms of updates for the subcommittee.
Thank you so much, Jose. Obviously, continually want to thank you for your voice on the council. You continue to move the needle on a lot of different topics, and I think also just help to leverage the voice of our previously incarcerated individuals on the council, and it's just really appreciated.
Thank you.
Quick update, Direct Services Subcommittee met on January 10th, a small but very interactive group of people, and some of the kind of next steps for that committee include a focus on voter registration and outreach as we move towards some local and national elections. Efforts of the committee will also focus on community engagement to educate on different legislation that was passed that's reentry focused. We also want to continue to work with HSH on the possibility of a reentry navigation center. The group has also been, over the past several years, continually interested in improving late night releases and warm handoffs. And then lastly, it was raised earlier, but the group would really like to see more support for the work of peer specialists. So the next meeting for the Direct Services Subcommittee is on March 7th. And that is the end of the staff update.
Okay, thank you everyone for providing updates and agenda item 4. Do any of the council members have any comments related to the staff report on the activities of the Reentry Council and its subcommittees? Yes. Sheriff, Assistant Sheriff Johnson. Sorry, I promoted you.
So for the Direct Services Subcommittee, and for this meeting, for the next scheduled meeting of the Reentry Council, I think we'll be able to present some information about some direct services for gender responsive services for women in the WRC. We're not ready to make any announcements at this point, but we will be at the next meeting. So I just wanted to make sure people were aware of that.
Great,
thank you.
Is there any public comment related to agenda item number 4, to the staff report on activities of the Reentry Council and its subcommittees? Okay, hearing none, we will now skip to agenda item 7. Let me know if I've skipped anything. Agenda item number 7, to continue to move the needle on criminal justice reform. A groundswell from the community is pivotal. We're lucky to have several strong community-led reform efforts in California. It's my pleasure to bring up members of the Anti-Recidivism Coalition to provide an overview of their organizing and advocacy efforts and to let you know how you can get involved. So thank you, Sabrina. Present away. And are you? Who?
Clinton.
Thank you. I wasn't sure if you were Nate. Okay, so you're Clinton. Thank you. Welcome.
So for those of you who don't know who the Anti-Recidivism Coalition is, it's an organization that was started in 2012 in LA in response to the injustice that was going on in the juvenile criminal system. In that effort, in the initial forming of that of the organization, then they realized that when they come out, they're adults sometimes, and what's happening when they come out. And that's how it started. We're talking about LA. So it's very kind of celebrity-based, and
you know, they have a lot of support that way. We're not in LA, we're San Francisco, but we're equally as awesome. And so what we've had this chapter here, a chapter for about 2 years. You wouldn't know that, because we haven't really done anything. We've been waiting for the LA mama to like support us in different ways, when really we realized we're gonna just do it anyway. And working out of both of our homes and for free on our time off. On the couple of times I have off during the week, we're gonna start stuff. And the main focus is going to be, we're starting a support group, which we'll probably have at the United Claire's Clubhouse. You know, anywhere we can kind of do it in Oakland and San Francisco. And what that support group is going to be is people coming out of state and federal prison can come, and it's kind of like a lifelong meeting that they have at the parole office, but without the parole office. And in resource sharing, you know, like is probably the only contract that has been applied in the past 5 years that focuses on people not on probation that need jobs. I happen to be that job guru. And so getting people coming out of state system a job is, I mean, it's a no-brainer. Luckily, the probation department allowed me to work with state people for a long time, which led the path to the contract. But there's so many things that are not being addressed on a state level. I think we forget that, you know, the guys that are sentenced in the county system, then go to prison, they're state, and the state doesn't have the kind of money that San Francisco has to spend on reentry. And they deserve it a lot. You know, they deserve it just like anybody else. So the policy guy left, but we're going to definitely partner with him, because that's what ARC is mostly known for. It's their policy work. I was in a meeting at the District Attorney's Advisory Board, which is how all of this started for myself. And which I've noticed, side note, that when things are started anyway, without the funding and without the, you know, the kind of hands tied for bureaucracy, you know, that's really when stuff can happen. And we need to do this ourselves, obviously, because we know what's needed, and we are probably the only ones that are gonna really take those steps that need to be taken, like tomorrow. And we're here to ask for support and offer support. And I'm all over this in a problem, I think. I'm nervous. Why am I nervous?
It must be the podium.
It is. I just want to go over some things that I have written down that's important. So the programs that they have in LA, which we are going to work towards, and hopefully once they see that we're doing stuff, we'll get more financial support. They do an in-reach program in the prisons, and that in-reach program is a hope and reduction, which is former lifers going into the prison system and having, you know, workshops on criminal and gang anonymous. Like, we have a lot of drug-focused, addiction-focused groups and support groups, but, you know, some people don't do drugs and they still commit crimes. And so, I have a client now, he's a kid, he's 21, and he has never done drugs. And I'm trying to find a spot for him to go and get support from just doing a crime. And then that's his addiction, you know. So those programs are in prison. They have like board preparation classes. So if you're going before the board for parole, you know, how do you prepare for that? That's important. And then also relapse prevention. A youth offender program for also parole. Peer mentorship programming, which we talk about in several different capacities, probation, is really the pivotal part of having this work. You know, these guys come out of prison, they can help the organizations that they're working with, that they're living in. Right now, there's only two places that they can go to when they come out of prison here in San Francisco. That's Healthcare 360 and NGO, which both have pluses and minuses, but what they don't have is to use their people to help. You guys are there. At Healthcare 360, they get treated like they just got a detox.
you know, when there are a plethora of knowledge and experience, and you know, they can help. So that mentorship, the mentorship program we're gonna start on our own and just kind of connect. And that's where I want to let you guys know, if you have somebody that needs a mentor, please let me know. And we'll set up a way to get a hold of us, and then we can, you know, assign one of our guys, because it really helps. I recently started going into the parole office with one of my clients, and I went to his first meeting with his parole officer, and I'm as from NOVA. And I'm sitting there, and I was like, am I pushing it? Am I imposing myself? And in the end of it, it was like, no, it was great that someone went to the parole office with somebody, that somebody can be one of these guys that just gets them going into the system. You know, it's kind of hard to navigate if you don't know. Let's see, Ride Home, Ride Home program, which is awesome, because people coming out of prison, especially after doing a long time, often don't know they're getting out until 40 days before, or something like that. And they come out to the $200 gate money, but then what? So we have a voluntary hotline that we're all on, and you know, get a flash. So-and-so getting out of San Quentin, we pick them up. We take them to eat, get some clothes, figure out what they need, and go straight to the halfway house, and then do kind of a thing afterwards where it's critical adventures. You take them to do something important, DMV, phone, whole other story, and then also something fun at the beach or wherever it is that they're dreaming about seeing. All these things are voluntary. We do all this stuff on our own time. And from being from the Lancet Street and not expecting anybody else to have that kind of, you know, to get paid as well. But it gives it a little bit more effectiveness, you know, and it also, it's twofold. The people that are helping and the people that are getting that help, you know, is good for both of them. The policy advocacy part is going to be really big. I just talked to him and make sure I partner with that. But I was in a meeting one time at the council, and somebody said, hey, what do you think about, you know, maybe getting points for being on, you know, parole, that you get good time in prison, which is a thought. And then a week later, I saw this like memo, it was like an actual bill. Then I got it approved, and a month later, it went before the Senate. It was like, I didn't realize how possible it is for someone like me, if I had a thought, and to make that happen. So we're gonna do some policy trainings and some policy updates on what we're supporting, and then get with obviously him, and see what he's doing, and then go to Sacramento. And we also have classes to teach you how to speak, how to tell your story effectively. So we have Ernest, that goes into the county jail for the women's pod and teaches, you know, he brings a Toastmaster with him. It's like such a practical thing to know how to speak. You know, that's kind of where you know to speak. You're gonna speak in a job interview, and so those kind of classes are really important. And I feel like I did not go on the air anymore. Yes,
thank you.
Okay, so first of all, I want to say good morning and thank you very much for giving me the opportunity, to speak to you guys. Coming from my background, this is really crazy because I never thought in a million years being a convicted felon and a criminal gang member that I would be sitting before a whole bunch of police and officers. This is crazy, all right? So bear with me. I'm not going to be as nervous as you bring it. I just want to be very clear.
We're not all police.
Our program, like she said, started in there. And we're a startup. We're a Bay Area chapter of Anti-Recidivism Coalition, so we're in our startup phase. But we have a lot of goals and a lot of ambitions. And when I talked to Mr. Adami and Sabrina, they both felt like bringing to this panel would be beautiful, because we would basically just tell you guys what we're trying to do. And then we're going to go from there. Everything I do is voluntary. Currently, I pick guys up from prison, take them to breakfast, buy them clothes, take them to their transitional houses. I do that on my own time. Our program is going to be doing that, and it's going to be funded eventually, but we're going to start off by doing that too. We're going to start off by using United Players. They're going to give us a place to hold our membership / mentoring and support groups. Also, our meetings are held in Oakland, because we are the Bay Area chapter. We're not just Frisco. We're actually Oakland, Hayward, you name it, we're all throughout. And the goal is just to bring the policy changes. I was incarcerated at 17 years old. I did 25 years in prison. I've been currently out 4 years. And I was privileged that ARC was already established because I wouldn't be here before you here today. And the reason why I wouldn't be here before you today is because SB 260 is a bill that got me out of prison. Mm-hmm. SB 260 is a bill that gave myself a meaningful opportunity at parole after I showed you guys a transformational change that I changed in my life. And then when I went into the board, this was the first time that I ever, after this bill was passed and put into law, this was the first time I was ever able to actually make the board see me as a human being, and then also make the board see me for telling the truth finally after all these years. And that's why I'm before you today. So make no mistake about it, I'm very passionate about this program. We're doing a lot of stuff, like I said, voluntary. We're trying to partner with everybody we can from San Francisco County, Alameda County, and so forth, because this is a Bay Area coalition. So we do a lot of policy things. We're LA and Sacramento, that's another chapter. In our chapter, we go to Sacramento on a lot of the bills and stuff that you guys, you know, a lot of the things, the think tank that you have here, some of the things that come from here end up in Sacramento. And I don't know if you guys realize that, but it does. Some of the things that harp you or tie your hands start here. It starts in think tanks like this. And we're starting a support group. We're going to be doing policy training, mentorship stuff. We're looking for office space so that we can have a central hub to where people can come and get the resources and knowledge and understanding of what ARC is, what ARC does, and how we can help the community not have these guys go back to prison for recidivism, okay? Because recidivism is a big, big, big thing. And we say we want to keep recidivism low, but it's how we attack recidivism that keeps it low. And it starts right here. And so that's why we brought this to you guys. We hope that you guys will support us in our actions. I just want to say one thing. I kill someone, and I stand before you today humble, because I realize what led me to do that. I realized that the things that happened to me as a kid is what led me down that path of thinking that a gang member and other gang members were more of a family than I. So, having done all these times, having invested in myself and understand about myself, that's what makes me fight so hard to bring programs like this, be in programs. I go to Martinez Juvenile Hall every 6 months, and I go into circles, and I talk to the kids. And a lot of the kids don't really realize that they're not stuck. They don't realize that as long as they do good, as long as they change their life, as long as they transform themselves, they won't go down that road that I did. I was 17 years old in a male-dominated, strong prison, and it was scary. And I was supposed to be a big, bad, tough guy, and I was crying every night. So my job as a human being is to bring things like this to you and bring things like this to the youth. And that's where I want to work and do things with, is the youth, because I believe they're our future. And it starts right here with ARC, and I hope you guys will support us. And I hope I touched on everything. And I thank you guys. And I appreciate you letting me speak. Thank you.
So just to close it out, we will get information to everyone. I did also want to plug Future IDs on Alcatraz, which is stemmed from ARC, and it's a project that I'm a core collaborator on. It's February 16th is the opening, and we can't really announce it because of the federal shutdown, but it is, in a nutshell, a project that was started small with ARC in San Quentin, and it's really about how art can change the stigma of incarceration. And it's like Future ID is an art piece that was made by us,
And it's kind of, what would you like to do in your future? How do you see yourself in the future? And we've blown them up huge. It's like a huge thing. I'm going to send invitations to everyone. It's up for a year. 1.7 million people come to that island and will get exposed. It's open for any community organization to come and do anything on the island. I can take groups of people. I have my own pass. So look for that in the future. And thank you so much for giving us the time to do this. I realized that because we kind of changed the order of the agenda, I did not give Steve Adami a time to talk about the GOSO guy. So I know we have 10 seconds left before everyone's going to leave. We need 5 seconds.
Yes, four.
So my colleague, Destiny French, one of the colleagues, Ivana Smith, updated the guy and it's ready to go to the plane. And we have a quote, and we're going to reach out to all of you for some money. We're only going to print 1,500 guides because the digital version is almost done. We were going to show a picture of it today, and we're like, no, because we have some really good news. It's being developed in San Quentin, and one of the developers is up for parole, and we're hoping at the next management council meeting, he can come and do a presentation and kind of walk you through it. But it is really awesome, and Destiny, Lauren, and I cannot even figure out what the wheel on our computer spins, what's happening, and we're in the forefront of this conversation. If it doesn't work, you know what? It is kind of funny. But so we'll be reaching out really soon for some funds, hopefully, you guys want to help get this back in the next week or two. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Okay, so in all that skipping around, I did actually skip agenda item 5. I don't want to inadvertently invalidate this entire meeting. And I also want to keep everyone in suspense. So we're at agenda item 5, where we were going to get an update on the Juvenile Justice Coordinating Council. Chief Nance, do you have a...
Sure. Juvenile Justice Coordinating Council last met on December 4th. At that meeting, the council adopted the San Francisco Criminal Justice Racial Equity Statement for Juvenile Justice. It was overwhelmingly supported. We also took time to review our bylaws, and we'll have a subcommittee looking to revise the bylaws for the Juvenile Justice Coordinating Council. And I think that is the last piece of information.
Great, thank you. And are there any other updates from the Sentencing Commission, Collaborative Courts, or Community Corrections Partnership?
The CCP update that's in the minutes from the last meeting is the most recent information.
Great.
So
okay. Yes. Yes, please.
So the San Francisco Sentencing Commission met on December 12, 2018. During the meeting, the commission and the public received 5 important presentations. There was one which was an update on the criminal justice racial equity work group by Aria Flores, who's a discrimination investigator and policy analyst for the San Francisco Human Rights Commission. There was a presentation on the Safety and Justice Challenge Implementation Launch and Technical Assistance by Laura Joplin with Justice System Partners. A presentation on the Justice Roadmap Process and Future Vision by Gardner. A presentation on Trauma and Sentencing Planning by Dr. Gina Castro Rodriguez, Chief of Victim Services and Parallel Justice Programs. And lastly, there was a presentation on San Francisco Sentencing Commission Annual Report, which included a discussion of possible action. And the next meeting of the Sentencing Commission will be on March 13, 2019, 10 a.m. to 12 noon at the Hall of Justice, District Attorney Law Library, located at 850 Bryant Street, room 322, here in San Francisco.
Great, excellent. Thank you, everyone, for the updates. Is there any discussion from council members? Any public comment related to agenda item 5? Okay, and then agenda item 8. Or rather, as to agenda item 7, thank you for the presentation by the Anti-Recidivism Coalition. Is there any public comment? Okay, thank you very much. Agenda item number 8, which is a standing agenda item for council members to share any comments, questions, or make requests for future agenda items. For future meetings. So are there any additional questions or suggestions from council members? Chief Nance? Yes.
So there was a request by council member Bernal before he left that we add to a future agenda the ordinance by Hillary Ronan with respect to extending access to legal representation for minors 17 and under.
Okay, we'll make a note of that.
We could add that for action and possible, or for discussion and possible action.
Okay, and I think there was also not only that, because that may or may not be, that may have been resolved by the April 25th meeting, but other legislative proposals that are relevant to the Reentry Council. So I'm sure we'll be talking about that in April. Any other, yes?
Yeah, I'd like to propose we have the victims of violent crime coming to a presentation, because there's a lot of new information about things that we can do to help people that we're dealing with, that's dealing with that. So we want them to give us the information so we know a better way to navigate the information.
That sounds great. Did you get that? Okay, excellent. Anything else? All right. So we will now move on to agenda item 9. And we would now welcome any comments from members of the public on any item on today's agenda or about other business of the Reentry Council. Okay, hearing none, let's move on to agenda item 10. Thank you, everyone, for a great meeting today, and a sincere thanks to the public who was here today. The next meeting of the Reentry Council is scheduled for Thursday, April 25th, 2019 at 10 a.m. here at St. Anthony's Foundation, and we look forward to seeing everyone there. So is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Okay, Chief Fletcher, thank you for your motion. We need a second.
I'll second it.
Okay.
I was waiting.
Thank you. Assistant Chief, Sheriff. I'm just going to call you Chief.
Kathy
Johnson. Okay, all in favor? Yes, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Oy, oy, oy.
Making you sweat. I know. Where are we? What time is it? I have a training to do. Oh.
Thank you.
So why don't you